This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Marisol Lebron grew up in the Bronx, saw two sides of that borough. She was raised in Parkchester in that neighborhood. It was a vibrant and diverse community. She also saw how people in the Bronx dealt with stigmas of crime and poverty. Her Black and Latino neighbors constantly navigating tense relationships with the police. As Marisol grew older, she became more interested in connections between race, class, and law enforcement. And most of her research focuses on social inequality in Puerto Rico. Part of her family is from Puerto Rico, and Marisol has traveled there throughout her life. Today, she's a professor of American Studies at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania. Currently, she's at Duke as a postdoctoral associate with the program in Latino Studies in the Global South. Also this week, WNC is participating in a National Week of Conversation, along with other NPR member stations. The project is called A Nation Engaged. We're asking the question, what does it mean to be an American? And that is one of the things we will talk about when we meet Marisol Lebron today on The State of Things. Welcome to our program. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, tell us what it was like growing up in the Bronx in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, growing up in the Bronx in the 90s, I think a lot of people would associate with, especially if you listen to how Trump talks about quote unquote inner cities and Black and Latino neighborhoods, most folks not from there would think of it as some kind of dangerous hellscape on earth where you're at risk of, getting shot as soon as you step outside of the door. But for me, it was a really amazing experience. And growing up in Parkchester was amazing. It was a working class, lower middle class, predominantly black and Latino community with kind of pockets of Filipino and South Asian communities as well. And it was just people living their lives, you know, working, raising families, doing what they needed to do.
Did you have any sense of hellscape, or were people talking in a way that made it sound like they were living in hell?
No, I mean, I think it's like any other kind of working class neighborhood where it has its shares of difficulties, right? It's a neighborhood that has experienced over the course of the 70s onward a tremendous amount of disinvestment. And so Parkchester is actually a really interesting place because it is one of the three developments that the MetLife insurance company developed for middle class white families as a path towards eventual home ownership. So it's Stuyvesant Town and the Rivington houses, which are in Manhattan. And Parkchester was one of the developments that was built in the Bronx. And so it, during the 50s, was racially exclusive for only white middle class families. It was seen as this kind of vehicle for upward mobility, for teaching kind of white ethnics how to be appropriate mm-hmm. citizens and appropriate homeowners to eventually get out of the apartments, right? So with disinvestment in these urban areas during the 70s, it completely flips, right? And it becomes predominantly Black and Latino. And when that happens, when that white flight happens, it becomes associated with all of these kind of urban ills, right? So drug dealing, promiscuity, crime, violence. And so you start to see the kind of policing aimed at managing those crises.
Well, the disinvestment's interesting. I mean, that's a word, and it's got a number of syllables. But what what's really happening here is, you know, when people say, well, my grandfather came from Italy, and mine did, and he worked really hard, and he mm-hmm. did, and look at us now. We're doing really well. I'm a white professional. He didn't speak any English when he got here. Mm-hmm. Look at me. I'm talking on the radio. He lived in segregated white neighborhoods in Buffalo, New York, and there was capital flowing into those. The banks actually would lend to my Italian immigrant grandfather. They would not lend to his Black neighbors. Mm-hmm. So he and we built wealth. Here right. I am talking to you on the radio. His neighbors at the same time weren't building wealth because they were redlined.
Right.
And that's so you're talking about that in the Bronx. Let's feed capital. Let's flow the capital in, get these white immigrants working and buying into the American dream. And we'll do that by keeping Black people and Latinos out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a deliberate policy. if you miss that part, then you can't answer the question, how come my grandfather did so well and you didn't? Okay, so that's kind of what you're saying is the rough history of this.
Right.
Fascinating stuff. So how did your parents come to be there? How did you come to be living in the Bronx?
Yeah, so my parents are both immigrants. My mother is an immigrant from Spain. She came when she was a very kind of small child. She actually came on a boat, which was very different from my father's experience of immigrating from Puerto Rico, right? So he was a citizen. My mother was not. So my mother had to go through a naturalization process. My dad, you know, the kind of migration from Puerto Rico is became rather easy after the 1950s and kind of this post-World War II technology of, you know, expanded air travel, right? So he came as a teenager, and my mother settled with her family in the Lower East Side in New York, kind of, you know, working class immigrant community, super diverse community. And my father settled in Harlem on 135th Street by City College. And the way they met was actually that my mother went to an all-girls Catholic school, which I later attended myself with his sister. And his sister ended up introducing them. So they got together and, you know, the Bronx was still, and it remains, this place where for many kind of working class folks, it was a shot at owning their first house, right? Mm-hmm. And a shot at like relative kind of economic stability, right? And so they moved to Castle Hill and bought a little red two family home, and that's where I grew up. And then when my parents separated, my father later on ended up moving back to Puerto Rico, and me and my mom stayed in the Bronx, and so we moved all of one train stop away to Park Chester.
Well, tell us how that changed again, because that was a hope. By then, some things had changed, and there could be a hope of home ownership. But as you say, then the disinvestment took place in a rather steep way, and with that, these policing behaviors and criminalization of the neighborhood. But talk about that transition. What actually happens to make that work?
Right. And so, I mean, I think that transition is a transition that you see happening all around the country. It's not in any way kind of specific or only endemic to the Bronx, right? You see nationwide a shift out of the cities, right, for a major kind of industry to the suburbs and especially to the Sun Belt, right? So being in a kind of northeastern urban context, right, those shifts were even more profound than in other places. But really what was happening is these kind of industries that were in the Bronx, right, in kind of New York City writ large start to leave, right? And as industry is leaving, middle class and predominantly white populations are also leaving and leaving behind kind of some of the most vulnerable folks in those communities, right? And so what we start to see is really this pathologizing of those communities as responsible for some of the challenges that they were facing, right? So the fact that trickle-down economics doesn't work, right? The fact that people are self-medicating because they don't have access to appropriate resources, right? That gets seen as these kind of moral and character deficiencies that are about people in a particular space.
And
right.
Certainly, but in the case of the Bronx and New York City, Rudolph Giuliani capitalized on that in a big way, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And if we think about, you know, Giuliani applies broken windows kind of theory to the Bronx and says that these small, low-level crimes, such as someone, you know, smoking pot on a park bench, are indicators of some larger kind of social crisis that's unfolding. And what we see is this kind of, again, this issue of personal responsibility as opposed to kind of an interrogation of systematic inequality, right? So, again, why are people self-medicating and why is it criminalized when it's happening in low-income neighborhoods as opposed to kind of, you know, Wall Street brokers kind of doing...
Breaking the law all the time?
Yeah, doing coke
no
and
swats.
Very a la Wolf of Wall Street, yeah, right? Those are not necessarily constructed with the same kind of moral dubiousness, right? Yeah. In fact, it's celebrated within our popular culture, but definitely when brown and black folks are engaging in particular activities such as drug dealing or drug use, or even just being in public space. So if we think about the ways that in particular men of color are criminalized when just being in space, right? Being in their communities.
When you say criminalized, how does that play out? What does that look like on the streets?
I mean, I think you see it happening. And I'll speak from my experience from what I saw growing up, is especially, you know, it's one of these things where now studying this so many years later, you can kind of put some names to some of the things that you see, right? And so I remember in the 90s, there being a kind of uptick presence of police and private kind of security. So for instance, in Parkchester, we have our own kind of private security firm that also patrols the properties, and you would see them in stairways, patrolling the hallways and the corridors more often, patrolling the kind of public grounds of the complexes, things like that. And then you would also see the NYPD, right? And so you, that kind of saturation of these communities with police. And one of the things that I think now, after, you know, decades of this kind of intensified policing with zero tolerance and broken windows and, you know, what gets labeled as community policing, what we know is that that kind of saturation of these low-income communities of color or vulnerable communities with police, what it leads to is more interaction with police, more people getting locked up, more people being harassed.
We'll take a break right there and come back and talk more about this with Marisol Lebron. She's a postdoctoral associate at Duke University in the program of Latino Studies in the Global South. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, Marisol Lebron, a postdoctoral associate at the Duke Program for Latino Studies in the Global South. Her research focuses on social inequality, policing, and protest. We talked about an uptick in crime. Obviously, the economic conditions in that area are not going well. That can lead to more crime and therefore more police presence. Now, the police will tell you, look, we're here at the request of people in this neighborhood who were complaining that we were only out in the white privileged neighborhoods. Where are you? Our neighborhood, we can't even go out at night. And now here we are, and people are complaining that we're here. We can't win for trying.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something you hear a lot. And it's definitely something that I heard in the Bronx, and something that I heard a lot over the course of my research in Puerto Rico as well, right? And I think this is something that politicians will often use to kind of justify what are really these incredibly violent incursions into these communities. So this is not to deny that there is, you know, crime, or that certain people are kind of experiencing really heightened exposure and proximity to violence, right? I think that that is accurate. And I think that the fact that those issues are intensified for particular people has to do with a whole range of kind of issues of race and class, right? But I think what we have to listen to in those moments is, what exactly are people asking for, right? And likely they're not asking for their communities to be torn apart, right? They're not asking for a whole generation of people to be locked away in cages, right? I think what they're asking for is more access to resources. They're asking for a kind of accountability from the state, right? And I think that what we see is these kind of very extreme politics and policies being justified. And so in my research in Puerto Rico, you know, you would often hear residents say, asking the governor to intervene, and the thing they would say is, you know, we're not trash, we're not garbage, we're humans, right? And we deserve to feel safe in our communities. We shouldn't have to, you know, sleep on the floors of our apartments because we're scared of bullets coming in through the windows, right? And I think that for folks in other cities, right, or in other urban contexts around the country, right, those might be familiar kinds of words. But in that request, right, I think what they're asking for is what they're highlighting is how the government has largely been absent, mm-hmm. right, has not provided any kind of access to resources that would help build kind of safe communities. And when they do make a reappearance, they come in as this repressive force.
Yeah, I mean, we see so many cases where many of the incidents involving police violence recently have included individuals who, victims who had mental health problems. Mm-hmm. And of course, serious cutbacks in mental health services, mm-hmm. the way we've seen in this state and others. I mean, this is part of the resources that you're talking about, education.
Right.
And then again, historically, if you don't allow capital to flow and people to build wealth, then when the hard times hit, there are no resources mm-hmm. to rely on. And of course, the people who had the privilege were allowed to follow the jobs. And
right.
so these are some of the built-in things that you're talking about. So what's going on there today? Have things changed?
Yeah, my mom still lives in Parkchester. So so she still lives there. I go pretty often. I definitely go less often now that I'm here in North Carolina. It's a little bit more of a trek. But definitely when I was at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, you know, I would go up there every couple of weeks. And so the neighborhood is, you know, it's still very much this place that is provides a space, I think, for people who are trying to get some breathing room in New York City and economically, right? I think being priced out of places like Queens and Manhattan and Brooklyn, the Bronx still kind of gives folks an opportunity to be homeowners or at least to like have a somewhat kind of manageable rent, you know. And one of the most interesting kind of transformations I've seen in my community is this really vibrant, wonderful South Asian community, the growth of the South Asian community. And so that's been something really interesting to see, and I think tracks this kind of shift of Puerto Ricans out of the community, Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, in particular to places like Florida, right? And this new kind of group growing and really building kind of a community there. But I think, you know, the other thing that's interesting is these kind of debates around gentrification. And so, you know, we've got a Starbucks, we've got like an Applebee's and things like that. And so there's this kind of hyper concern about whether the community is going to remain affordable. And, you know, I'm really interested in those debates because I think and again, this goes to our previous kind of point, is like, what are people calling for in those moments? And what are people kind of trying to flag with some of these discussions? And so I'm really interested in the way in which people in the Bronx and in Parkchester and in other, you know, all over are kind of like, we want access to amenities, right? We don't want to feel like we need to always leave our community in order to get access to fresh produce, in order to have entertainment, right? But it's a double-edged sword in some sense, right? Because the minute those resources and amenities start coming into a community, that are, especially those that are recognizable, like a Starbucks, right, or certain kinds of stores, right, those become you know, warning signs for decreased affordability.
Well, again, if you keep cutting back on public services and mm-hmm. endlessly privatize, then what you end up with is privileging those who have historic privilege. So if you say, well, that was a long time ago, we ended Jim Crow in the 60s.
Right.
If you have a system that says, okay, we're going to take the gloves off now, but we're going to take away public assistance that generation enjoyed and you don't have now, who's going to benefit by that uptick in mm-hmm. prosperity? The people who historically had been.
Right.
And so that leaves those folks out. And so I hear what you're saying. What about your – let's talk about your personal life a little mm-hmm. bit now and your own education. Your mom went to an all-girls Catholic school, and I guess so did you, right?
Yeah, I did too. I went to Cathedral. And that was also an interesting kind of experience because – you know, I left the Bronx every day to go to school, right? To go to what felt like, you know, a good school for that kind of, you know. So I think there's a way in which when you come from certain communities, there's an assumption that you need to leave your community in order to have some kind of shot at social mobility. And I think that that's a problem that needs to be addressed, right, is in terms of that question of allocation of resources. Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely, you know, I went to, so it was an all-girls Catholic school, private school, right? But it was definitely when you hear private school is not what you have in mind, right? So all of my classmates for the you know, vast majority were young women of color who were coming from the outer boroughs, right? So all having 1 to 1.5 hour commutes in to attend school, right?
In Manhattan. You said Manhattan.
Yeah. So you had young women from Bronx, from Queens. You had some from the upper parts of Manhattan, right, or the Lower East Side. But, you know, it was in Midtown. It was in Sutton Place, right? It's completely elite area of Manhattan. And so it was definitely an experience where, again, it solidified some of those kind of questions of what do people have access to. But it was definitely, you know, for me, I went to this all girls Catholic school, working class, you know, primarily women of color, and then kind of got thrown into an all white context then when I went to college. Right. And that was my first time. You know, being around that many white people.
You went to Oberlin in Ohio.
Yeah,
right?
I went to Oberlin in Ohio. So it was my first time kind of living outside of New York in you know, any kind of substantive way. And, you know, seeing kind of farm and pasture lands on the way from the airport to Oberlin. But it was a really amazing experience for me. But it was definitely one that was, you know, quite difficult and quite a shock, I think, in the beginning, just because, you know, I had thought that I had, you know, I did really well in school. I had thought that I had, you know, I went to kind of a college prep after school program for youth of color. So I felt like very well equipped to be at college, and I felt like very capable. And then I got there and I was like, oh, so this is what other people are getting.
Well, first, let me, before I get you to describe what it was you encountered in that feeling, why did you choose Oberlin?
So I chose Oberlin. It's going to sound totally corny, but I chose Oberlin because of its kind of activist history and its history as for co-ed education, is one of the first schools with co-ed education. Its kind of history as part of the Underground Railroad, right? Its history with African-American students and other students of color, that really meant something to me when I was choosing a college. So I chose it. I was like really coming into my own politically at that time, and I was very interested in these questions of kind of racial justice. And so Oberlin was like the space to do that. And when I went, I got admitted and went to visit for this recruitment weekend for the students of color. And it's like as if the whole thing was choreographed. Like, it couldn't have been any more perfect. Like, it was this amazing day and everyone was out on the quad and there was like a steel drum band. I mean, like, totally picturesque. And I was like, oh, this is college. This is amazing. I have to come here.
Was there beer anywhere?
There was totally
There's beer.
Beer.
Okay,
and, you know, yes, I will say that college definitely made me a beer connoisseur now. In my But definitely, it was very picturesque, very cool. It felt very cool, very hip.
Turns out that doesn't happen every day.
Yeah, it doesn't. It does happen quite often, though, at Oberlin.
Well, what was it like? You talked about the shock of, you know, sort of feeling you were prepared. It has this history. You're going in. You're coming into your political consciousness. And then you get there, and there's just, but you're still feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah.
What was that?
I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting because Oberlin, for a small liberal arts college, has it's quite diverse in comparison to many of its peer institutions. But when you're there, like, those numbers mean nothing to you, right? Because what you feel is that kind of sense of racial or economic kind of disconnect, right, with your peers. And so being in classrooms with folks who had gone to Dalton or Phillips Andover Academy, who were just prepared in a completely different way, who had completely different kind of social norms in relation to understanding kind of the quote unquote ways of the world, right, and what it means to be in these kind of elite spaces. So that was quite a shock, right, because I felt like, you know, I felt equipped, and then you really understand what kind of those levels of privilege and kind of the ways in which folks are circulating in spaces that you didn't even know existed and that you can't even understand, right?
So, and was this any, did you have any sense of overt or, you know, sort of in, you know, deliberate kind of discrimination, or is this just something you felt because now you're exposed to, as I say, different ways of thinking and you hadn't considered that?
Yeah, I think it's just seeing the kind of access and resources that people had that just were completely foreign to me was where I saw that.
You also came out as a queer woman in college. Tell us about that and the decision to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if you're going to come out anywhere, Overland is a pretty good, nice place to do it. It's definitely a super queer friendly campus, and everyone was extremely supportive. And I think that was something for me as when I was trying to figure out who I was and my sexuality, like knowing that I wasn't going to lose friends, right? So thinking about those kind of issues that keep people from coming out, right? And this is not to kind of like valorize the coming out story as like everyone needs to come out, but for me there was no danger of it at Oberlin.
Was
right?
there any thought in your mind, though, of what would happen when you went home, or how this would be received, or if I had done this if I were still in the Bronx?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think for most people when they come out, right, it's a shock for their parents, even if they are supportive, right? Yeah. And so I think, you know, my mother had the kinds of concerns that many parents have, right? So if we live in a society that is, by and large, extremely homophobic, right? And particularly for me, as someone who is not gender conforming, right, who kind of presents as a masculine woman, she was very concerned about my safety, right? And I think had a lot of anxiety around that that is quite understandable, right? That you know, it took us some time to work through her feelings of kind of concern and fear for my safety.
How did your experience at Oberlin, or did it, influence your decision to become a professor and do research?
Yeah, so I think Oberlin was definitely the place where I was like, this is how I want to spend my life, right? One, because I love college. I love college students, I think, you know. But that environment of really seeing people start to grapple in really significant ways with kind of what they want the world to be was really powerful and was definitely my experience in college. And when I started was the year that comparative American studies at Oberlin had really taken off. And it was a space to really explore issues of social inequality, issues of social justice. And it was also the faculty who were in that program were queer, were people of color, and really modeled for me this kind of commitment to facilitating students' kind of discovery of these issues and really stoking their curiosity and commitment to these issues. And that was quite powerful for me.
How did you become interested then? Because your research now focuses on policing and inequality in Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so how I got started on that topic was actually a really weird roundabout way. And initially when I started, I went on to grad school at New York University. And when I started at NYU, I had thought I was going to do work on underground rap and reggaeton music in Puerto Rico and the U.S. and Latino communities. And I started doing this research and I kept coming across these like record store raids that were happening
in Puerto Rico.
And it's led me to this whole policing initiative called Mano Dura Contra el Crimen, Iron Fist Against Crime. And then I fell in love. Well, fell in love is like the wrong word, but then I got really interested in researching and learning more about it. And that's how I got started on that path to policing.
Well, I want to hear a clip from one of the songs that may have got you started on this. I think this is Eddie D's song, Señor Oficial.
Señor oficial, déjeme cantar mi canción. Señor oficial, déjeme ser como yo soy. Señor oficial, comprenda que usted hizo hace tiempo la cosa que yo hago hoy. Señor oficial, no diga que soy un ladrón. Señor oficial, tampoco que soy un matón. Señor oficial, mejor di que soy un cantante que lo hace de corazón. Señor oficial, venga, quiero hablarle.
Clip from the 1997 song Señor Oficial by the Puerto Rican rapper Eddie D. My guest is Professor Marisol Lebrón. So tell us what was going on in that song.
Yeah, so that song, one of my personal faves, is a song that Eddie D does after these record store raids and after this kind of public panic really erupts about underground rap music. And so this panic erupts in Puerto Rico for a variety of reasons, right? So Puerto Rico is experiencing kind of record rates of homicide, kind of a lot of social insecurity around questions of drug trafficking and drug use. And people are searching for solutions, or not solutions, but kind of causes for some of those insecurities. And underground rap kind of emerges as one of the explanations, right? So it's like underground rap is inducing young people to use drugs and to be promiscuous. And on top of that, it's exalting kind of U.S. black culture, right? So that also threatened the kind of conception of what it meant to be Puerto Rican, right? And so towards the tail end of that, those controversies, Eddie D comes out with the song, and what he's doing in the song is, it's called Señor Oficial, so like Mr. Officer, and he's trying to reason with the police, and he's like, why are you persecuting us? Why are you blaming us for all of these social ills? All we're trying to do is make music and have fun, right? And so that's kind of the what you hear in the chorus and then in the verses.
Well, we'll talk more about the official policies and political rhetoric that led to that crime crackdown in Puerto Rico and its outcomes when I continue my conversation with my guest, Marisol Lebrón, a postdoctoral associate at Duke with the program in Latino Studies in the Global South. Our conversation continues on the state of things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Marisol Lebrón. She is a postdoctoral associate at Duke in the program of Latino Studies in the Global South. And we're talking about her research that looks at social inequality and policing in Puerto Rico. And talk a little bit about the political campaign around this rise in crime, particularly violent crime in Puerto Rico.
Right. So what I look at is this policy known as Mano Dura contra el Crimen, as I mentioned, so Iron Fist Against Crime. And it really starts to emerge. The guy who named it is the governor of Puerto Rico, Pedro Rosselló, at the time in 1993, kind of establishes this policy. But it's really building the kind of policies and logics that get implemented in 93 in the late 80s, right? And so we see this rise of a kind of volatile, informal, drug-based economy on the island, which I argue has to do with kind of the failure of U.S.-led development on the island. So if we think about that colonial relationship between Puerto Rico and the U.S., right, in many ways, Puerto Rico's hands are tied in terms of how it can kind of respond to political, economic, and social crises, right?
I'm going to stop you there just to talk a little bit about sort of other developments and the ways in which changes in policy can affect the local economy mm-hmm. and then lead to these outcomes. Mm-hmm. An economy that had been based, there was a great thriving agricultural economy. Mm-hmm. The bottom pretty much falls out of that, and people are now in Puerto Rico importing 85% of their food. This isn't because people don't want to grow food anymore. These are economic trends that pull people out of agriculture and into jobs that don't necessarily pay.
So that's actually a really interesting point, right? So the statistic of 85% gets cited all the time in terms of food importation and food sovereignty issues, right? And so the reason why that happens is that we see in the 1950s and 60s Operation Bootstrap as this industrialization effort that's happening in Puerto Rico, and part of the cultural stuff that happens with Operation Bootstrap is this denigration of agricultural labor, right? Which is not to say that agricultural labor in Puerto Rico was, a paradise, but it was extremely exploitative, right? But it goes almost to the other extreme where industrialization is seen as the only economic path forward. And when that collapses in the late 70s, right, there's nothing really there to take its place. And so what we see is these efforts at kind of managing crisis over and over again that erupt, right, from this inability to kind of deal with some of these large scale economic problems that are confronting the island. So you see that from everything from kind of the food sovereignty issues to these issues of crime.
Right. And so then again, how this plays out in policing is not just the policing, but now a kind of theory of who's responsible that becomes a public consciousness, whose fault it is. And then the fix would be a very strong kind of violent reaction mm-hmm. to crime in Puerto
right.
Rico.
So when we see this uptick in the informal economy, the kind of folks who are blamed for it are public housing residents and other kind of low income populations around the island. And so What Mano Dura does is send police and National Guard into public housing and to raid them and then kind of suppress drug dealing and drug use in those locations. And what we see is it kind of reinforces this understanding that's already circulating in Puerto Rico around who is responsible for crime, who is responsible for making you feel unsafe, right? It coalesces with a lot of really classist and racist ideas that were very much already circulating at the time. And it operationalizes those, right, as a solution.
So what did you find? Interestingly enough, you went down there to start your research in 2011 now, mm-hmm. which was an interesting year in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, so I would go in 2011, and the project that I had imagined myself doing was not the project that I ended up with, and which I'm very, very immensely grateful for. But I had imagined actually talking a lot more to kind of police officials and understanding their rationale behind some of these policing initiatives. Like Mano Dura and those that followed in its wake. And I go in 2011 and the DOJ, like a couple months after I got there, the DOJ issues a report that is a really damning report that calls Puerto Rico one of the most corrupt and dangerous police departments within U.S. jurisdiction, right? And so it's particularly damning if we think about Puerto Rico as the second largest police force in U.S. jurisdiction right after New York, right? So the police force in Puerto Rico, 17,000 police officers for an island of 3.5 million residents, right? And so residents' interactions with this kind of violent police force are common, right? And so it's really alarming. And so when I go down there, no one was talking to me, right? And so there was a kind of I encountered a lot of silence. I encountered a lot of resistance to accessing documents when I went there because of its kind of colonial governance structure, right? There's always debate over who has what documents, right? And so doing FOIA reports for the local housing authority and then HUD, and nobody says they have anything, right? So the project that I ended up doing really shifted and ended up focusing much more on how did those who were being policed understand these initiatives. So really trying to pierce that rhetoric of what these initiatives do is provide safety for people, as we mentioned earlier, for people who are asking for it, right? Who are asking for it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so what did you find when you asked that question? Is this what you asked for?
What I found was that it didn't actually produce any more safety for folks. And what it actually did was, in many ways, increase people's proximity to crime and violence. So what those policing initiatives did, and what I would argue you see happen in other contexts where you have this kind of very intensive targeted policing, is that it concentrates the violence and the crime in those particular areas. So when Mano Dura, for instance, goes and raids a public housing complex in Puerto Rico, what they do is they throw up a fence around that public housing, right? And so it effectively concentrates the problems within its walls, right?
Now, the police would say, well, no, the problem was there. We went there in force because that's where the crimes were being committed in large numbers. And so we needed large numbers to react.
Right. And so if we think about, I mean, that's something you hear quite often, is that we went into public housing because that's where the drug dealing is. Right. And so, again, it's this myopic kind of focus on low level offenses. Right. So if we're talking about where the drugs are coming from or who is actually benefiting from the traffic of or from the sale of drugs. Right. It's actually happening in kind of middle class and high income kind of urbanizaciones, so gated communities. Private gated communities in Puerto Rico, right? That's where the real kind of criminality is happening.
So if you want to put your resources anywhere, put it upstream and choke it off at the source instead of coming downstream here and picking off a few users.
Right. And so what you see is really these attempts to kind of, arrest, corner boys, right? And the kind of particularly young black and brown men from public housing, but also women are being arrested during this time. But, it gets gendered as the problem is these young black and brown men who are on the streets or in public housing selling drugs. And so not only are these kind of young men putting themselves on the line in terms of being worried about catching a bullet from a rival drug dealer, but now they have to worry about catching a police bullet, right? Or spending the rest of their life in a federal prison in the U.S., right? Away from their family and friends. So these concentrate these kind of forms of insecurity among the very populations that it proposes to be helping, right?
I wonder what it was like for you, because you said that your parents were divorced, your father went back to Puerto Rico, and therefore you were visiting more frequently and became familiar with the island. Was your, when you started doing your research, did you feel like an insider or an outsider?
Yeah, I mean, that's a question that I still struggle with, and now I think I've decided I'm an outsider, and I'm kind of comfortable with that. But very much when I started, you know, I used to go like every summer to visit my dad and my family, and I have a, you know, half brother, half sister there. I have a, you know, a lot of family there, so I always felt like very attached and felt, you know, like I knew what was going on. And then I went to do research, and I kind of got confronted with the fact that I had made a lot of assumptions about my own familiarity with what it meant to be Puerto Rican, what it meant to kind of experience these structures, that I actually had to really check myself and open myself up to doing a lot of listening and kind of humbling myself to asking for folks to share those insights with me. And especially if we think about the kind of nature of the questions of what I was asking, which are questions about police violence and kind of racial and social inequality. I mean, those are really hefty kind of topics to be interviewing people about. And it was a really amazing experience, those moments where folks were able to trust me as someone who was not from their community, right, to share those stories and take the time to really contextualize those stories for me, right, because I didn't grow up there.
I wonder what impact it has psychologically, because, again, if you take it back to your childhood, a moment when, you know, the dream is that people who may not be wealthy now can work hard and work their way into these spaces that you found daunting when you went to Oberlin. It's like, oh, these are places of privilege. But we have this myth in this country that you can work your way into those spaces. Mm-hmm. What happens with this political rhetoric that racializes a crime, not only to the people who hear it from the outside and say, oh, it's those people who are causing this, what happens to people on the inside, to their sense of mobility, their sense that they could ever, even if they work really hard, be welcome in those spaces?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. That's one that I actually encountered in my research. So one of the, a large part of what I look at, in addition to the actual kind of policy Mano de Contra el Crimen, is this kind of legacy, you know, two decades later, is how have people kind of reckoned with the ways in which it's solidified some of these associations between blackness and criminality and poverty. And so one of the sites that I looked at its legacy was actually at the University of Puerto Rico during the UPR student strikes in 2010 and 2011. And that was a place where that kind of myth of meritocracy, right, was challenged, right? And we saw students on the one hand fighting to maintain open and accessible, non-privatized public university, and the administration hiring young black men and women from Loíza, which is a predominantly low-income black community and Afro-Puerto Rican community in Puerto Rico, hiring them to act as private security to break the strike, right, and really pitting those young people against each other. And the thing that was remarkable is that many of the young people from Loíza had said that was the first time that they had set foot at the UPR, which is the Puerto Rico's premier public university, right? And so I think that's, you know, Loíza is a place that has experienced in intense racialized and class disinvestment and hostility, right? The fact that the only time they were able to access any kind of proximity to the UPR was to work as violence workers.
Well, and that has a long history and goes way back to the history of colonialism, this business of taking the most desperate of people in a given area and pay them to be the divide between them and the dissident class.
Right. And so I think, you know, that's part of what we definitely saw happening in Puerto Rico during the UPR strikes, is we really see young people who, although with different levels of intensity and in different ways, experiencing the effects of social and economic crisis in their communities, right? Trying to manage that crisis and being pitted against each other.
Well, and you're also teaching this a class right now on the ways in which Latinos experience the criminal justice system here. And you go back to the annexation of northern Mexico and talk about the way, again, colonial theory is with us today. But tell us more.
Right. Yeah. So I'm teaching this class. It's actually my one of my favorite classes that I've taught so far is this class that it's my second semester teaching at Duke called Policing Latinidad, From Border Wars to Mass Incarceration. And that's right. I start with the annexation of northern Mexico and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, right? And as this really essential moment for understanding some of the ways in which Latinidad has been sutured to ideas about criminality, right, and degeneracy. And so what we see is after the annexation of northern Mexico and the westward settlement, right, Anglo settlement, what we see is this discourse of criminality. We see this application of extrajudicial kind of violence that very much, although extrajudicial includes law enforcement officials, right? So if we think about the growth of the Texas Rangers as primarily aimed at aiding white settlement in the Southwest and West, we see that crime and these ideas of kind of racialized property went hand in hand, right? And so we start with that in my class, and we look at the kind of the history of lynching and the establishment of the border as really this moment where resources and property are being consolidated, and law enforcement plays a key role in distributing and protecting that access to resources.
Along racially, intentionally, right. Racially divided lines. So right. I asked the question we asked at the very beginning of the program. If we think about all this and all of your research, and we're asking ourselves this week, what does it mean to be an American if you're a Latino? And I don't mean for you to speak for the entire community, but you know, if we see it through that lens and that filter, how do you see it? What does it mean to be an American?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really big question, right? And I think that what it means to be an American is felt really differently because of the ways in which Americanness, right, American citizenship is tied often to these kind of exclusive categories, right? And so when we think about kind of what it means to be an all-American, right, and we're picturing, you know, white heterosexual males, right, and all the folks who are left out of that, I think the kind of limitations of those categories are really important to keep in mind. But I do think that we see, you know, the kind of growing movement of Black Lives Matter and these conversations around what it means to have access to justice and rights in this country are really illuminating the ways in which these structures of, you know, American values are, you know, enforced at bullet point differently in different communities. And we're really seeing, you know, thanks to social media, I think for many Americans, that experience is not the same everywhere.
Well, thank you so much for being on our program, Marisol. Marisol Lebron is a postdoctoral associate at Duke. She's in the program in Latino Studies in the Global South. Thank you so much for being on the
program.
Thank
you for having me.
This is the State of Things for today. That's our program. We're going to be in Greensboro tomorrow, and you can join us. You can be in our live audience. We're going to be at the Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. It's free. All you have to do is let us know you want to be there. Send us an RSVP at our website, stateofthings.org. It's easy to do. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, and Katie Barron, as well as Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.